As Hogland began walking on the lake, the dog began running in circles as though demented and had to be restrained with its leash. Suddenly, a whining sound came from above. Looking up, Hogland saw a saucer-shaped, translucent craft about 5 meters in diameter. He could see figures moving inside, reports Haka. The object came closer to the ground in a spiraling movement. It stopped before touching the ice, and a dark tube was lowered from under the object. This tube was seemingly made of a soft material since it moved in the wind. He felt a breeze of hot air with a distinct smell of hyacinth. His first thought was that this must be a Russian machine. But he soon changed his mind. From the tube, 4 entities floated down, as though they were in an invisible elevator, and walked up to him. They were 3 men and 1 woman. Other than for a translucent overall, they were naked. One of the men seemed old, while the others looked younger. They were of normal height, had very large, dark, somewhat slanted eyes and perfect teeth. Their skin had no blemishes and there was absolutely no hair on their bodies, not even genital hair. Richard was especially fascinated by their ears, which were large and pointed. The ear opening in the head was very large, as on a cat. He thought he could almost see into their heads. The men seemed very strong, like wrestler types, with bull necks. They had a slight oriental look about them. The entities were covered by the clear plastic overalls which looked like they were held out from the body by air pressure. Hogland became confused, though not afraid. Through sign language and drawings in the snow, the entities started to communicate with him. They seemed fascinated by his hair, and he had to remove his cap several times as they laughed and pointed at him. When he tried to touch their overalls, however, they quickly retreated, as if they did not want him to do so. Using a small black package, they sprayed something like a gas on everything, including the dog, before they touched it. The dog evidently objected, as the gas had a strong smell of hyacinth. Hogland himself smelled of hyacinth for several days afterwards, causing his wife to wonder if he had already bought flowers for the coming Christmas. Communications in sign language continued for a while as Hogland tried to explain a number of earthly pursuits, such as hunting and dancing. The woman meanwhile played with the dog, which was out of character since it normally became aggressive towards strangers. All this time, the strangers appeared to be walking on an unseen layer, as their feet did not touch the ground. When the woman patted the dog, she too leaned her knee against this unseen layer. On their left wrists the entities wore a broad, black bracelet with a yellow button, which when touched seemed to alter the effect of gravity on the beings. The older man indicated that he knew about pygmies, by demonstrating how they hunted with bow and arrow. He also seemed to indicate that his people would come in great armadas in the future. After further communication, the older man returned to the craft and fetched an object the size of a cylinder or microphone, which he proceeded to run along Hogland's back. At this, he felt a sensation of warmth, vibration, and sudden relief from the kidney pain that had troubled him for 15 years. By now an hour had passed and it began to grow dark, at which point Hogland noticed that the craft was now surrounded by a blue phosphorescent light. The whole craft seemed to vibrate. Except for the dark cylinder underneath, it remained semi-transparent, consisting of 2 shells, the outer one rotating. Inside, the craft seemed Spartan. All that could be discerned were 3 shining cylinders standing on the floor. Terminating the communication, the entities entered the craft, which then took off at tremendous speed, changing color from blue to orange as it flew away. The following day, Hogland was x-rayed at Ardeva Hospital. Much to the bewilderment of a Dr. Hartman and his colleagues, no trace of the kidney stone could be found. Subsequently, Hakan told me, all the X-ray plates were checked by Dr. Carl Erik Svensson in Stockholm, who confirmed that no stone was visible on the plates taken after the encounter. Second contact. On August 24, 1966, Hogland felt a strong impulse to visit another lake outside Ardeva. The urge was so powerful that it felt as if someone else was driving the car, a sensation recounted by Carl Anderson. Arriving at the lake, he saw the same kind of craft hovering above the water, beside which a man seemed to be suspended in the air. Spotting a small rowboat nearby, Hoggle climbed in and headed toward the craft. He recognized the man as the same with whom he communicated during the first encounter. This time, he could hear the man speak, presumably in Swedish, though his speech did not synchronize with his lip movements and seemed to originate from the craft slightly delayed. During this communication, Hoggle learned that world peace was threatened because the USA and the USSR supposedly planned a war against China, and that he should go to the Bahamas to act as their contact man. He was given a metal plate with strange hieroglyphic type symbols embossed thereon and instructed to wear it at all times. Hoggle explained that such a mission was impossible. He was an uneducated man, did not speak English, and in any case had a wife at home. These objections were brushed aside, and Hoggle felt obliged to comply with the order. Following the encounter, however, he buried the plate in woods near the lake and then returned home. Despite serious misgivings, Hoggle and Gunvor went ahead with the plan. To finance their trip, they sold everything. On March 5, 1967, they flew via London to Nassau, thence to Little Exuma, a small island in the Bahamas where they had been told to go. Hoggle did not bring the metal plate with him, however. During the flight, the couple noticed 14 passengers dressed like priests, all similar in appearance, who supposedly disappeared in an unusual way on landing at Nassau. Apart from this incident, nothing unusual happened during the trip. The couple returned to Sweden. Ashamed to resettle in their hometown, they bought a cheap house trailer south of Stockholm, where Hoggle was able to find work once more as a rock blaster. Surrealistic developments. In ensuing months, Hoggle became involved with ufologist Kusselskapit, a Stockholm-based UFO group which had become interested in his story. Among the members was a wealthy building contractor who offered to finance Hoggle in the event he was ordered to the Bahamas again. He decided therefore to recover the metal plate. On the drive from Gothenburg, after picking up the plate, he stopped at a gas station, where an old man approached and asked him for a lift. Hoggle consented, as he felt tired and thought it a good idea to have someone to talk with during the journey. The man was dressed in a black cape, boots, and a big slouch hat. After a while, the man asked Hoggle if he recognized him. He replied in the negative. But suddenly it dawned on him that the man was one of those dressed as priests on the outbound flight to the Bahamas. The man introduced himself as Father Rapaz, later contracted to Rapaz, and said he worked for the overlords, that is, the beings who had contacted Hoggle on the two previous occasions. Rapaz suggested a coffee break at a motel. He took off his hat but ordered nothing to drink. By now thoroughly confused, Hoggle began to worry that the stranger might be an illusion, so when a boy passed their table, Hoggle knocked the hat onto the floor. The boy, assuming himself responsible, picked up the hat and apologized. Father Rapaz was no illusion. Nothing had happened in the Bahamas, Rapaz explained, because Hoggle had not taken the metal plate with him. He was told that we must return to the Bahamas, this time not forgetting the plate. 734.5 centimeters in size and about 1 centimeter thick, with a coarse back, the plate appeared to be made of an aluminum-type material, engraved with 3 rows of cryptic symbols. At times, the plate became so hot that Hoggle kept it in asbestos. He also said that it gave him rashes, caused by the asbestos, perhaps? After continuing the journey for a few more miles, Rapaz suggested that he should take the wheel. Hoggle pointed out that Rapaz seemed rather elderly to drive, he guessed about 70 years old. If you double that some 10 times, you will be closer to the truth, came the riposte. Exchanging seats, Rapaz proceeded to drive the old Volvo as if it were a racing car. Hoggle protested, explaining that the police might have speed traps. Don't worry, said Rapaz, I can sense where they are. Hoggle fell asleep. When he awoke, the car was parked beside the road outside Södertälje. There was no sign of Rapaz, who had left a package of fruit on the seat. An alien base? The building contractor in the UFO group now agreed to finance Hoggle's second trip to the Bahamas, the money to be mailed via a school teacher in Nykoping by the name of Trygve Glantz. Hogland and his wife returned to the Bahamas around the New Year period of 1967-68, staying initially in Nassau. When nothing happened during the first 2 days, Hogland lost his temper and threw the metal plate on the floor, shouting that he wanted nothing more to do with the whole business. That evening, he claimed to have been visited by three humanoid beings of rather oriental appearance but distinctly different from those encountered in Sweden. They delivered a sharp warning to Hogland not to act like that again. On New Year's Eve, acting on instructions supplied to him by Ray Pars, Hogland went to the harbor in Little Exuma Island and contacted an old black man called Joe, who owned a boat. A girl called Lee was also aboard. Hogland was told to lie down in the boat, presumably so he could not see where they went, Hakan told me. The boat was very fast. They arrived at a small island where, through an opening in elevated terrain, they entered a secret base. At some point, Lee, presumably one of the space people, demonstrated her ability to walk on the water outside the boat. Ray Pars, who had arrived before them, acted as a guide. In the base, Hogan met 23 different supposed representatives from various planets. Some were giants, some were dwarves, and others hermaphrodites, Hakan reports. He was shown a three-dimensional film of human history from the birth of Christ. During this experience he collapsed 3 times and had to be revived by Ray Pars. He was also shown a collection of weapons from all ages and given the mission of starting a peace movement in Sweden, though told that he himself should not appear in public to promote it. The new generation, back in Sweden, during a meeting of contactee-oriented enthusiasts in January 1968, a statement written by Father Ray Pars and dictated to Hogland, who did not attend, was read out. A new international peace organization should be started by the group, it began, with the approbation of the overlords. The organization was to be named the New Generation. The statement contained so much drivel that it is a wonder anyone took it seriously. Among Ray Pars's exhortations are the following: your catchwords shall be, freedom from violence, from hunger, we are all brothers and sisters. You who have supported Richard shall not be forgotten, you shall reap a hundredfold, but if someone hurts him or his devoted wife, I say, they shall be revenged sevenfold. The group also received Ray Pars's rules 65 philosophical points, one of which is more than enough to suffice here: if there should be interplanetary people among you, which I believe is rather rare, don't let them go to heaven but bring them down to earth again and demand more work of them. Most members of the group felt uneasy about Ray Pars, his threats, and the new generation and their platitudes. The building contractor, for instance, had been asked to pay thousands of kroner without knowing what he was really supporting. And Hogland, thoroughly disillusioned, became reclusive. As a result, the group split up, though Trygve Glantz continued to act as spokesman. Interviewed by a Swedish newspaper in mid-1968, Glantz was quoted as saying that the now 600-member organization had been created by the West Indian peacemaker Ray Pars as a worldwide peace movement in the spirit of Martin Luther King. The article went on to mention the organization's plans for a large meeting in the fall that year, to be attended by the singer Harry Belafonte, Ralph Abernathy, a leader of the American civil rights movement and assistant of Martin Luther King Jr., and King's wife Coretta. The meeting never happened. In the article, Ray Pars is referred to as a wealthy industrialist who, during his travels around the world, had seen so much misery that he decided to devote his wealth to charitable causes. 4. Back in the Bahamas. The aliens encountered by Richard Hogland in the Bahamas were of human appearance, with thin, pointed features, deeply tanned, with a somewhat oriental look, long tapering fingers and dark eyes, Hakan learned. They all seemed perfect, not a blemish on their skin. He never saw the beings from the initial contacts in Sweden again. During the New Year period of 1968-69, Hogland and his wife returned to the Bahamas. One night, he told Gunvor that she could meet one of his contacts at a discotheque in Nassau. Gunvor protested at visiting such a venue, but her husband insisted. They found a table on the second floor and Hogland began looking around for the man. He left the table and returned with a man dressed in an ill-fitting brown costume, Hakan learned from Gunvor. The man just nodded his head in a short greeting to Gunvor. He was rather short, his skin had a peculiar suntan, and he had a slight Mediterranean or Oriental look. The clothes were too large for his rather thin body. The man returned to his table. Richard explained that the man was one of them. When Hogland and Gunvor started dancing, the man came up and watched them very closely. He looked straight into Gunvor's eyes. There was a sort of hypnotic power in his eyes. "I will never forget those eyes," she said. The man showed Hogland a photograph of his family and house, supposedly on another planet in our solar system, which Gunvor recalled her husband referring to as either Venus or Saturn, she couldn't be sure which. During this and another trip to the Bahamas, there were three in all, Hogland met others like himself, who acted as couriers for the space people. One was a Russian, another an African-American named Lofton Anderson, with whom he became good friends. Anderson, it transpired, was an agent for the Central Intelligence Agency. During 1968, Little Exuma was swarming with CIA agents, Hakan reveals. Anderson had informed the CIA about the alien base. Later he was found dead with a bullet hole in his head. He had been killed for treason. Several photographs were taken of Hogland in the Bahamas. The entities themselves, however, could not be photographed. Instead, there was an illuminated square on the photo where one of them had been, Hakan explains. Hogland remembers one episode when he sat on a bench, talking to one of them. Suddenly a stranger walked by and Hogland felt very embarrassed as it appeared as though he was talking to himself. These people had the ability to disappear into thin air. Another peculiar feature of the aliens was that they never seemed to sleep or eat, though they did drink, and even smoke. Also, Hogland never met any women among them. A coincidental element in this saga is the Mafia. Lou Chesler was the front man in the Bahamas for the big Mafia boss Maya Lansky, Hakan told me. Richard and his wife found an ad in a Swedish newspaper in the autumn of 1968 about work in the Bahamas. They applied, and as they had been there before, they got the work through a Swedish man. Richard was to be butler and his wife housekeeper at the Chesler residence in Nassau. They worked there for a couple of weeks before being forced to leave because of new laws by the government. During those weeks Richard met the visitors several times. 5. Hogland was allowed the use of their cars and drove an unused but old model of a black Cadillac, like those reported in other cases involving the proverbial men in black. "The strange thing was that it couldn't be crashed," said Hakan. "It had a sort of magical eye that steered it. When you learned the trick it was very easy," he claimed. In a letter sent from the Bahamas in early 1969 to a friend in Sweden, Hogland wrote, "I cannot and am not allowed to disclose what we are doing here, but I can tell you this much. We are in a school here, and as you can understand, the teachers are interplanetary." 6. Disturbing developments. The building contractor having withdrawn his financial support, Hogland had to rely on his alien contacts for funding. "Obviously," Hakan commented, "this group had unlimited economic resources. One day a man from a car firm visited Hogland and gave him a new car. He said it was paid for and was to be delivered to him." Before the third trip to the Bahamas, Hogland contacted a friend who was to take care of his apartment, pay the rent, and care for the indoor plants. The payment for this service would be sent from the Bahamas to a special bank account. Hogland paid just 5 kroner into the account before he and his wife left. On the very day that they went to the Bahamas, someone paid 1,000 kroner into this account. Every week it increased by a few hundred kroner, but the receipts never stated who had put the money there. No money ever arrived from the Bahamas. When Hogland and his wife returned, they were very anxious as they thought they must owe their friend, who had looked after the apartment, a lot of money. When the friend explained that there was always money in the account, they first thought he had given it himself. But later they realized that some of their space contacts must have made the payments. Following the leak of information about the Bahamas base to the CIA, the aliens moved their base to an area outside Mexico City. Henceforth, Hogland's foreign trips were to Mexico. He was often away from home for a month at a time. After the third and final trip to the Bahamas, Gunvor no longer accompanied her husband. In October 1968, during the Olympic Games in Mexico City, Hoglund claimed to have been taken to the new base. He became very upset as he was not allowed to attend the games. "I had the feeling he was afraid," Hoglund's friend Dr. Carl Svensson revealed to Hukan. "He told me in general terms that he had been in Central America. I don't think he really knew where he was." Further contacts also took place in Sweden. Hoglund's wife always knew when a visit was forthcoming because her husband became restless and got up early. He claimed to have been taken on board spaceships during this period, but information on these contacts is scanty. He took his car to a secret location south of Stockholm, where he was picked up by a craft, Hakan told me, referring to the first trip. He was blindfolded and had to lie down on the floor. The craft was very small, he couldn't stand up. After that first trip, he became nauseated, but later adjusted to these experiences. In the early 1970s, Hoglund said that he had been operated on by his contacts. As Gunvor related to Hakan, he had a lot of headaches before, and took pills. "One day, when I was going to work, he said that someone is coming and something is going to happen. He didn't always tell me when they were coming, but this time he told me not to come home too early from work. After that day he never had any headache. They did something to him and he said he would not have survived otherwise. It was some form of tumor, which was removed. I looked at his head but there was only a slight blemish. He was a bit pale and tired afterwards, and was told to rest a few days." 7. Hoglund's contacts reportedly continued until his death, from a heart attack, on October 23, 1977. He was 64. Alternative scenarios: there is the possibility, of course, that Richard Hoglund might simply have been insane, or been suffering from delusions engendered perhaps by the tumor that had been operated on. This might explain at least some of his claims, but not according to those closest to him, including his wife. Nonetheless, there are a number of alternative explanations for his seemingly fantastic and farcical assertions. First is a hypothesis that he might have been spying for a foreign power such as the USSR, using the alien element as a cover. Hoglund was a communist, Hakan told me. There was much Soviet infiltration of Sweden at that time, he notes, and Hoglund had a friend who worked at the Swedish Navy base in Moscow. He also had Soviet contacts. Was he just a member of the Communist Party, or an agent? Asks Hakan. After all, he had been asked by his alien contacts to obtain a map from that base. It is not known if he succeeded. But in any event, such a request, combined with his translating or decrypting some form of codes, raises suspicions, as does his trip to Mexico City in 1968 during the Olympic Games, when Soviet penetration and subversion were at a peak. Hoglund acted as a courier for his contacts, Hakan emphasized. He translated coded messages in the form of numbers. The codes disappeared in a few days, invisible ink. He went to different places, like airports, to deliver envelopes with information for his contacts. Many of his activities sound like ordinary espionage. I believe the UFO story was a cover for probably Soviet espionage. His order to start a peace movement also indicates this. What of the car given to Hoglund in Sweden? In checking Soviet activity at the time of his contacts, I noted that the KGB, the National Security Agency of the USSR from 1954 to 1991, had an auto dealership in Sweden, the Motorcobil AB, with offices in four cities, used as a cover for espionage activities. In 1971, the Swedish newspaper Dagens Nyheter reported that police frequently followed Soviet car salesmen to mobilization centers, radio stations, and other sensitive defense installations. Pilots complained that radio transmissions emanating from the auto company, beamed to Soviet warships in the Baltic, disrupted their communications. 8. Prior to the contacts, Hoglund and his wife had seen an advertisement for land in the Bahamas, and he wanted to build a hotel there. Hakan wondered if the order to go to the Bahamas might have been a cover to persuade his wife to accompany him. The fact that one of Hogden's financiers was a building contractor also raises suspicions in this connection, though that financier had withdrawn his support after the first Bahamas trip. There is also the question of Hogden's psychic abilities. By all accounts, he was a gifted telepath, and in my opinion this might have been a reason for the contacts, whatever the nature of those contacts. Moreover, he had other paranormal abilities. I thought, before, that there was no psychic component prior to the contacts, Hakan said to me, but his wife told me that he sometimes went off and talked in a strange tongue. Also, he wrote a strange story about nuns and monks in the Middle Ages during one of his previous incarnations. So, he was, after all, a mystic. That changes the whole picture. Also, Hogden excelled at telling stories, not lies, according to some. Although Hakan believes the espionage hypothesis to be a possibility, he concedes nonetheless that there are aspects of Hogden's story which are difficult if not impossible to explain exclusively in terms of Soviet espionage, a vested interest in the Bahamas, his psychic abilities, or his talent for telling stories. In June 1984 he interviewed Gunvor, then in her 50s. Like her husband, she is very down-to-earth and practical, he explains. She confirmed almost all the details of the contacts. When Gunvor first heard about her husband's experience in 1965, she was stunned. I believed him, though, she told Hakan, because Richard never lied to me. He was almost cynical, and believed neither in God nor the devil. If several of the people involved in the affair hadn't been very close friends of mine, whom I have no reason to doubt, I guess I would never have started an investigation in the first place, Hakan declared in 1984. But there are just too many witnesses involved to dismiss the case. Gunvor herself not only encountered one of the extraordinary beings in the Bahamas, which left her in a state of shock, but also with Richard at their apartment near Stockholm. She described these men as beautiful and tanned, though, unlike the man in the Bahamas, extremely well dressed. No way out. Most of those who knew Hogland, including his wife, were reluctant initially to go on the record under their own names, out of what seems a genuine fear of his sinister contacts. Hogland himself was both afraid and mistrustful of them. I'm not allowed to say anything, he admitted to Hakan, during their one and only communication, by phone, in 1973. People would be shocked if they knew of these things. I've already said too much. 14 months before he died, he reiterated these concerns in a phone conversation with a friend of Hakan's. What I have gotten into is negative, he lamented. You become very isolated. I warn you against going deeper into this. Asked why he did not simply stop working with the beings, Hogland explained that he would go the same way as Lofton Anderson. There is a way in but no way out. During the first few years of his contacts, he felt that he owed them some help in return for healing his kidney. Later, things got worse. You don't know what kind of a hell I'm into, he remarked. In the event he could take it no longer at some point, he carried a suicide bill around with him. Hogland obtained very little information from his contacts. If he asked something, he said, they would return the next day after consulting with the overlords. Nonetheless, the Russian friend of Hogland's, mentioned earlier, who claimed contact with the same beings, said that Hogland seemed to know more about them than he did, after working for them for 20 years. They are totally without feelings and can witness the most brutal torture, Hogland once revealed to a friend. It means nothing to them, he felt like an animal in their company. In some ways, he said, they seemed stupid, and not even telepathic. They claimed to come from another planet and were here to prevent a third world war. But Hogden speculated that their real objective was to take us over from the inside, by infiltration. A different evolution, rather than emissaries from another planet or planets, is it perhaps more likely that the group involved with Hogden following his initial encounters in Sweden was of terrestrial, rather than extraterrestrial, origin? Also, there are parallels with reports of the notorious men in black MIBs. In his initial appraisal of the case, Hakan cites John Keel, the well-known author and leading investigator of the MIB phenomenon. On a number of occasions, wrote Keel, I actually saw the Phantom Cadillacs as advertised, complete with sinister-looking Oriental-like passengers in black suits. On Long Island, following the directions given me in an anonymous phone call, I pursued one of these cars down a dead-end road where it seemingly vanished into thin air.